This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Patrick Clancy's civil suit against Lindsay Clancy's providers is what we are talking about today. Not the criminal case that's going on. We are certainly covering that as well. But what about that civil case? What's going on there? And what's in there? What's in that suit? It's very interesting. We're going to break it down. And I'd love to get your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we do exactly that. January 23rd of 2023, Lindsay Clancy sat down for a scheduled appointment with her mental health provider. The appointment lasted 17 minutes. That number comes from a lawsuit her ex-husband filed. And according to that filing, it wasn't unusual. Her appointments that month all ran about 17 minutes. The next day, her three children were dead. Cora was 5, Dawson was 3, Callan was 8 months. Patrick Clancy is their father. And in January 26, almost 3 years after he buried his kids, his lawyers filed a wrongful death lawsuit in Norfolk Superior Court. Lindsay Clancy isn't named as a defendant. The people who treated her are. He filed on behalf of himself and the estates of his three children. An estate is the legal stand-in for someone who died. That makes Cora, Dawson, and Callan plaintiffs in their father's case. What sits inside that filing is a 4-month record of a woman asking for help and a detailed accusation about what happened when she asked. Somebody wants to compare this to Chris Watts and insert other case here. And there may be some that do have legitimate comparable angles. But comparing it to some of these is utterly insane. We'll make another video about that. But here's what happened here. Here's the details of this case before you just go, well, what about that one over there? Well, that's not this one. And here is this one. And here's why. Wrongful death works like this. A family member sues and claims that negligence caused a death. And negligence means care that fell below what a reasonable professional would deliver. A civil jury decides whether that claim is more likely true than not. Nobody goes to prison because a civil case is about responsibility and money. That standard is a lower bar than proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which prosecutors have to clear in a criminal courtroom. The difference matters because two cases about the same three children are moving through two different counties, and one of them will finish first. Patrick's suit names two providers and their employers. Dr. Jennifer Tufts is a psychiatrist at Aster Mental Health, and Lindsay first contacted her in September of 2022. Rebecca Jolotta is a psychiatrist nurse or psychiatric nurse practitioner at South Shore Health System, and she started treating Lindsay that November. Lindsay worked as a labor and delivery nurse at Massachusetts General Hospital. Callan, her youngest, was born in May of 22, and according to the filings, she spent roughly 4 months seeking psychiatric care before her children died. The complaint's language about the prescriptions is blunt. It says the providers misprescribed a bevy of diverse and powerful medications and added new drugs in an ad hoc manner. Ad hoc means without a plan. One drug isn't working, so another gets added. And then another, not exactly something anyone should be doing with prescription drugs, ever. And they know it. The exact count depends on the filing. The civil lawsuits say Lindsay was prescribed 9 psychiatric medications in the months before the killings, including 8 inside a 3-week stretch. Her criminal defense team puts the number at 13. The lawsuit also is describing what Lindsay was telling her providers while the prescriptions changed. She said repeatedly that she believed the medications themselves were causing her symptoms. Those symptoms included worsening insomnia, depression, and thoughts of ending it. The warnings came from the patient herself directly, and more than once, according to the filings. Her own complaint lays out what she did as she got sicker. She went to the emergency rooms, called crisis hotlines, admitted herself to hospitals. She took the medication she was prescribed and kept reporting her worsening symptoms. Patrick's complaint is specific about what should have happened next. It says the provider should have run tests to learn why Lindsay reacted badly to drugs like Zoloft and Prozac. Lab work would have shown whether her body was metabolizing the drugs, meaning breaking them down instead of letting them build up. The complaint states no lab work was done. And in mid-December of 22, Lindsay was admitted to a partial day program at Women and Infants Hospital in Rhode Island. A partial day program means a patient gets treatment during the day and sleeps at home. According to her suit, a psychiatrist there concluded she had no postpartum depression and ruled out bipolar disorder because there was no family history. Notes in her own file showed her sister had postpartum anxiety. At the end of December, she entered a program at McLean Hospital for patients with postpartum depression. She reported feeling detached and hopeless, according to her filings. Her suit says the program was staffed by a skeleton crew over the New Year's holiday, and it calls the care she received there grossly inadequate. After she was discharged, the lawsuit says her providers noted her poor mental state. The filings allege that adequate follow-up still never happened. And then January 23, she was back with Dr. Tufts. The suit says Tufts' own documentation described Lindsay's condition as deteriorating, a word that came out of the provider's file and not a lawyer's argument. Deteriorating. According to the complaint, on January 16th, Lindsay reported that caring for her baby felt forced. Her last appointment came on January 23rd, and it was a whole 17 minutes, like the others. Her children died on January 24th. The criminal trial is built for a long fight. The witness list runs past 180 names and testimony expected to stretch across 6 to 8 weeks. Jurors were taken to see the family's home in Duxbury. Two courtrooms are working on competing explanations for these same three deaths. In Plymouth Superior Court, prosecutors are trying Lindsay Clancy for first-degree murder in a trial that opened on July 27th. The state alleges she planned the killings. Prosecutors have suggested she didn't take her medications as prescribed, and they're questioning how severe her illness really was. You know, non-medical professionals questioning how serious it really was, because the evidence actually shows the real medical professionals never even bothered to really truly check. Lindsay admits she killed her children and argues that she can't be held criminally responsible because of the postpartum psychosis, which is the insanity defense. In Norfolk Superior Court, her ex-husband's filing argues the opposite chain of cause and effect. It says that with adequate care, it's more likely than not the children would still be alive today. The father of Cora, Dawson, and Callan put his name on that claim. He's suing the treatment system while the state prosecutes the patient. The same man stands at the center of both cases. Patrick was the prosecution's first witness at the criminal trial, and jurors heard the 911 call he made from that house. The plaintiff in Norfolk County spent 2 days in the witness stand in Plymouth. The two cases will touch. Legal analysts have told News Nation that a conviction could likely be used in the civil cases to challenge Lindsay's credibility if she testifies, and acquittal generally wouldn't come in at all because the standards of proof are so different. Whatever happens in Plymouth could shape what a Norfolk jury ever gets to hear. Lindsay filed her own malpractice suit, separate from Patrick's. Hers names 11 defendants in all, including 7 individual providers, plus McLean Hospital in Belmont and Women and Infants Hospital in Rhode Island. Her complaint says her insomnia after several antidepressants was a red flag for bipolar disorder that her providers failed to recognize. Her amended complaint pushes that argument even further. It says Lindsay kept reporting intrusive thoughts. Her providers, the filing argues, failed to recognize those thoughts as auditory hallucinations. Her complaint describes a male voice that ordered her to harm her children and herself. Her suit also puts a diagnosis on the record. After the killings, a Columbia University psychiatry professor evaluated Lindsay and diagnosed her with bipolar disorder. That evaluation found her symptoms first appeared in 2020 after her second child was born. Patrick's suit stays a little narrower, aimed at the two providers closest to Lindsay's final months and the systems they worked inside. Patrick and Lindsay divorced after the deaths, and he has since remarried. Lindsay survived January 24th with injuries that left her paralyzed from the waist down. Patrick has said publicly that he forgives her. He's also said the woman described by strangers was never the woman he knew. Lindsay was indicted for murder in September of 23 while she was still in the hospital. The employers named in the suits have answered with statements, not specifics, though. South Shore Health says it prioritizes patient safety and can't discuss the litigation. McLean says it can't comment on any specific patient and that it mourns the loss of the three children. Astor Mental Health didn't respond to the Boston Globe's request for comment. Every allegation in both lawsuits is exactly that, an allegation. Nothing has been proven in the civil cases. And the criminal case, Lindsay is presumed innocent unless a jury decides otherwise. She admits to the crimes, but she says she's not responsible because of the postpartum psychosis. The timeline in Patrick's filing still ends the same way, with a 17-minute appointment on January 23rd and everything that followed on January 24th. The lawsuit argues those 2 days didn't have to be connected. Cora was 5, and her family remembered her as a girl who wanted to be a doctor and a mama when she grew up. She practiced by giving her baby brother checkups. Dawson, 3, had bold brown eyes, his father said, beamed with friendship. Callan was 8 months old and smiled constantly. He died 3 days after his brother and sister in his father's arms at Boston Children's Hospital. Patrick has said he'll always call that boy his little hero. What the world will call his mother really depends on who you talk to. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. I'd love for you to weigh in there. We'll continue our conversation. There. If you want to follow the case, if you want access to the trial, all of the updates, all of the testimony day by day as it goes on. We got it for you on our podcast platform, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. The link is right there. The QR code on the screen. If you're watching us on YouTube, follow that. It'll take you to your favorite podcast player. Hit subscribe and take us with you. In the car, at work, at the gym, walks, whatever you're doing. We do appreciate that. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Let's talk about more of the case itself. 8 days of a testimony, actually 9 now in the Lindsay Clancy trial. Something strange keeps happening. The prosecution's own witnesses keep describing a wonderful mother, her friends, her nanny, Patrick's own father. Then a medical examiner walked the jury through what happened to 8-month-old Callan. And Lindsay sobbed so hard the judge had to stop the trial. You guys have a lot of questions about this, a lot of statements coming up over and over. And we're going to try and get to a lot of your questions in this case, in this segment. And our next, we're going to talk about Nancy Guthrie a little bit too. So that's coming up. So hang out for that. And of course, drop your questions in the comment section as we now kind of move on to the actual trial itself, not the conspiracy that somehow naturally everything seems to have come along with a conspiracy these days.
Die out.
It's true, though. It feels like every case we cover now is a conspiracy. It just used to be some cases we get a conspiracy. Now it seems like everyone.
Well, you know why? The algorithms feed it.
Yeah.
That's why they do. People come up with it really to invent it so they can get hits, likes, subscribes, and everything else. You know, so if you're a nutter, you get more likes and you make more money. I mean, it really, the Google machine supports nutters.
That's true. It does. I mean, if you can come up with a crazy idea on a case, you're going to get people looking at it. Yeah. She Googled the takeout, sent her husband on the errand, and had exactly enough time. This is a comment. I want to believe she was sick, but that looks like a plan to me. Somebody talk me out of it. Okay. Talk her out of it, Robin.
Science is solid. I looked it up again, and Siobhan can speak to it better because she's licensed in this area, but a psychotic break. You can actually do that volume and that amount of pre-planning and still be in a psychotic break. Because when you hear the word psychotic break or psychosis, we're really thinking that it's a brain on, brain off. It's a different... I think people kind of naturally, their brains go to kind of like schizophrenia. They become someone else.
Yeah.
That's not the way it works. And it's also, it ebbs and as I understand it, it ebbs and flows out of how aggressive it is or how it recedes. And when you're in it, you can be in it for minutes, hours, days, or weeks. And it's something added on top. So she was having command hallucinations is part of what she's saying she had, which is part of psychosis, part of this. These command hallucinations, and I looked this up because the real legal battle here is, should she have been reasonably able to make a choice to overcome command hallucinations in the psychotic break? Because that is really what is at stake here, and this is what the real trial is about. Is the choice and understanding of what she was doing was wrong, and she had a choice to not do it. And so that's why they're examining these command hallucinations. And so these command hallucinations are added on top of everyday life, so it cannot, for others outside looking in, it does not look like she's in psychosis. Matter of fact, that's why the psychiatrist said she did not present as being in psychosis, even though internally she was in psychosis. And this is what the next group of people on the stand are going to show, and also as described by her and all the people in her life, because the only thing that would explain the behavior that she had of killing her three kids with all these people saying what a great wife, mother, not overwhelmed, not trying to get out of being a mother, all these things, the only thing that would explain that would be a psychosis event. And mm-hmm. So that's why you can do planning while still in a psychosis doing these horrendous things. And the compulsion that someone feels and the fear they have of not doing what the command voice says is that it's that overwhelming, that prevalent, that it's unless you've ever experienced one yourself or witnessed one in person, I think it's very, and that's why people have a challenge with this one. It's very, very hard to understand exactly how powerful that is and why it actually is a reason for the insanity plea.
I've been trying to think of a way to try and make an analogy or to understand this better. Bear with me. I'm going to give it a shot here. I'm just kind of coming up with this on the fly. It's a horrendous, obviously, thing that she did. She admits to doing it. And on the outside looking in reality, it obvious horrific. It's horrible as it can get. There's not a world where a healthy brain's going to look at that and be like, oh, this is normal. This is just another thing. This is as mundane as it's raining outside. Let me get the umbrella out. You don't think anything of getting an umbrella out when it's raining, because it's raining. To be in a psychotic state almost, I've never been in one, but this is how I would try to understand it. If it's a sunny day and your brain is telling you it's pouring out, everyone else around you knows it's a sunny day, but your brain, it's stuck on saying it's raining. So no matter what anyone says to you, you're going to take your umbrella because that's just what you do. That's your expectation here. When she's in this state, horrendous, this idea of killing the kids and taking them to God because it's her last chance, that act in her mind is not horrendous. That act is not, oh my God, this is horrible. It's about as eventful as taking an umbrella out and going into the rain. It's what you do. It doesn't make any sense. It's not based in reality. It's not even based on anything of any sense whatsoever, but her brain is firing in a way that is just as fucking normal as it is to take an umbrella out when it's raining. And I think that's what's hard for people to understand, because we're all going, oh my God, you're going to do this to your children with these exercise bands? And she's just like, put the umbrella up and go outside. It's It's just that simple. There's no extra thought to it. There's not contemplation. There's not, oh my God, I'm killing my children. It's just, it's an action. It's what you do because the voices are telling you. And that's the scary thing of the psychosis and being in that sort of a state is crazy, horrible things seem like just another Tuesday to you. And that's how people are able to carry them out so easily and readily, because there's not the safeguard. There's not that emotion or that pause in your brain saying, this is wrong, this is bad. And that's what's being litigated. Was there anything telling her, this is wrong, this is bad? And they're saying, no, in a state of psychosis like this, because there's a difference between being psychotic and being in a state of psychosis.
Yeah, as well as mental health issues,
yes,
too, because mental health is not an excuse. That's why Nick Reiner most likely is not going to be able to claim mental health as a defense.
Yeah, exactly.
I have firsthand experience with a few people in my life with things I've done. With the only thing I can come close to is withdrawal symptoms from like alcohol or drug abuse.
Yeah.
I have known people, very, very sane, good people that were completely sober, but only I think like 24, 48 hours when this happens, when the auditory hallucination starts. And so here's someone completely sane, completely sober, that's having hallucinations, auditory hallucinations, where, no kidding, they heard music in walls, completely sane, having a conversation with me, taking a sledgehammer that I got to take out of their hands because they wanted to break down the wall, even though they said, I know it can't be there, but I got to turn this goddamn music off. And they break in trying to break down walls because they heard music coming from a wall.
That's what? How real it is. Yeah.
And they knew it, but they couldn't stop it. Even though they weren't even on anything anymore. That was just the residual effect of hallucination, of an auditory hallucination, and something at the level that Lindsay was going on. It's like a full psychosis that was way above and beyond. And so, that's why it is the only thing, and it's so rare. I think the last case I saw where it actually was claimed as a defense. And worked, I think it was the 80s. And so because again, it's 1 in 1,000 women suffer from this, and even less do something horrendous against their kids for this. And that's why it is that rare. That's why it strikes us such a chord with us. That's why people come up with conspiracy theories, because when you actually see her life arc and everyone in her life saying it couldn't have been her. I mean, just think about this. If she had not admitted that she was the one that killed these kids, we'd be looking for another killer right now, because no one in their right mind would believe she did it.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I think you would have had a lot of people. I mean, obviously, the evidence is there. I mean, that's nearly impossible to dispute. But you're right. I mean, the fact that she flat out said, yeah, it was me.
I mean, yeah. I know there's a lot of other evidence, but if you remove maybe the method, time, place, you know, so there's not the data and the evidence for it, and you remove her confession of it, because of who she is and how she's lived and all the testimony and everything, you would be looking for someone else. People would be looking much harder at Patrick or anyone else in that family in life, because I mean, I would, my first response would be not her.
Yeah.
Because all these things, very much like, and I know it'll flame a lot of people, very much like Richard Allen.
Yeah. I mean, there's this is a very clear case of what psychosis truly is.
It really is. It's the best
because
it does
go from one extreme to another very fast. And in a lot of other cases that this keeps getting compared to inaccurately, you see a buildup and you see premeditation. You see someone who's planning something. This was not that. And even if this was, I mean...
And she did. I mean, she did a little. She did some research here and there.
Yeah.
Moments before, or maybe, so give her grace.
Yeah.
You know, say, all right, so she planned it for a day or two. Okay, that's still within the realm of a psychotic break. I mean, well within it.
And when you're in that mindset, it's like when you think it's raining out, you're going to do preparations for the raining. And the raining in her mind was a voice saying that you only got so much time to take the kids out. Doesn't make any sense, but you're going to do preparation for that, because in your brain, that's just another Tuesday. It's all on track. And that's what's so scary, because when you can pop out of that, you're like, what the hell was I thinking? And that's, I'm sure, what she's feeling in that courtroom. of like, how did my brain betray me in such a way? And whether that was because of going on and off of all these medications in such a short period of time, I'm going to guess that played a role. But the thing is, with this case, even more so, anybody who's arguing the medications issue, take the meds out of it. Her brain was fully capable of doing this madness all by itself.
Yeah. Yep.
The meds just exacerbated the problem more than anything else. That leads us to the next question, another comment that we see quite often. Here's what it says verbatim. The prosecutors held up 9 pill bottles full of pills. This is being all dramatic in court. So which is it? And this is what they want people to believe, that's so black and white. She was over-medicated or she wasn't even taking them. Those both can't be the story. No, but they can. They can very much both be the story. Because when you go on, when a doctor is prescribing meds, and we're seeing how the doctor has prescribed them, very ad hoc is pretty much how it was, meaning at will. Most of these meds, there is, if you're going on them in a healthy function, it's normally, okay, this may take 2 to 3 months to really kick in. What was going on here is she was on them for a short period. The doctor, she's saying, this isn't working. And rather than being like, it's going to take more time, they're like, oh, let me give you a different one. Let me give you a different one. Let me give you another one. Let me do this one. And one's not communicating with the other. And you can't mix some of these things the way they were being mixed, because that can lead your brain to go crazy, which is exactly what happened. Surprise. And people are having a hard time understanding this, and I guess bless their hearts, because they've never dealt with medication like this on a personal level for themselves or anyone close to them. Consider yourself lucky. But if you have, you'd understand how those things work. And the repercussions of it aren't just you had too much or too little. It's the interactions of them. Mm-hmm. And you're relying on the professionals to medicate you. But she was a labor and delivery nurse. Yeah, she wasn't a prescriber of psychiatric medication.
Oh, yeah, big difference.
So I don't care that argument. She's going to a professional, and the professionals are failing her. Being a labor and delivery nurse doesn't excuse the problem. And they're failing her, and she's relying on them, and then this happened. But we still want to blame her. I don't get it. I do not understand why there is this strong desire to not understand what's happening here. It's not even this strong desire to go after her. It's like a willingness to ignore facts, to ignore reality, and ignore even trying to understand mental health and how these medications work. I don't know why. Is it because it's too scary? And it's too icky to think that people are capable of this sort of shit, or that the drugs that we readily take, that our safe doctors prescribe to us, that are advertised during our favorite television shows, could actually end in ways like this. So we just kind of keep that over there and pretend that that's not anything. It's just bad witch lady over here. It's Massachusetts, after all. We're good at burning witches there. I mean, this really kind of feels like that at the end of the day. This feels like a modern day witch trial. We're basically saying, medicine doesn't matter. Mental health is not a thing. She's evil, burner. And all the evidence to the contrary is over here, but we're just not even going to take that in. This is a modern day witch trial. Like, in every sense of the imagination, every sense of the word.
It's a hard thing, I think, because this, again, because a psychotic break and psychosis, postpartum psychosis, is so rare and unusual, we don't have a frame of reference to really grasp our minds around it. And so we want to keep pointing the fingers everywhere else. And also, the fear is our greatest motivator. And when we fear our government organizations and institutions fall down, we get fearful. We want a place to blame. We want to do other things. I mean, most of the time, Tony, what we cover is the failure of our government institutions when it comes to law enforcement, the legal system. I mean, a lot of times those things fail us because they're imperfect. But never, ever have we really gone at a mental health system to this degree. I mean, it always pops up on these cases because mental health is always in the background noise of all these cases, because no healthy people do horrendous things, right? And so what we're seeing here, though, exposed, again, watch testimony. When you saw the psychiatrist Tufts up on a stand and you see someone who is fresh out of residency, 1 month out, taking a case like this on, and you see her lack of depth of field. Again, this is not it's a hit on her, but it's a hit on the whole institution, the whole, in other words, think in the terms of How desperate is our mental health system that you're going to hire her and put her lead on such a big case? Inside the FBI, my relation on this was, my squad of 12 people or 10, 12 people in New York City, I got assigned to work counterintelligence in New York City. Our main purpose, our main objective is to recruit intelligence officers working on behalf of the Russian government. In order to be given the highest priority case, like the most critical one, which could impact lives, nation states, you think they're going to give it to the guy that just turned 29 years old, spent, you know, a year in training, 5 years in the Marine Corps? No, they give me the case a little below that. And then if I have some reps and I show that I can handle some lower cases and get some more experience without an umbrella of a residency under me, then they'll give me a bigger one to be mentored, taught, and guided, or at least someone to bounce the ideas off of. But again, who knows what's going on? But the way that Reddington is exposing the system, and she is just a product of that system being Tufts, is that... Yeah. She was hired and thrown out to the wolves. She had no idea what the marketing was about. They promoted her as an expert at postpartum depression with females. Mm-hmm. And she had no idea about that. She has no idea that how the system, the intake system works and what forms are filling out online. Yeah. And I mean, there was so many gaps.
It's like everybody's got to start somewhere. I get that. And unfortunately, I don't think, and I'm not trying to make it an indictment on her. I mean, I think there was a lot of
system.
Yeah, a lot of missteps here, without a doubt. I can't imagine, like, you're new to this is your first, you know, year or two in practice, and then you get this, like, this would be enough to make you go, that was fun, I'm going to do something else. The system, this is indicative. This is norm.
This is
normal in the system, unfortunately. This is not abnormal. Most med checks are about 17 minutes, quite honestly.
Yeah, and she kept using a term that I think goes to the point of what we're saying with medications and the snip, snap, on and off. She kept saying, when he said, what was the dosage that you went by? Why did you choose this medication for her? And her answer always was, well, it's a general consensus. You start with this.
Yep. And that's how it works.
And so you start with what? And he said, well, who says it's a general consensus? And she couldn't answer any science, data, research. She says, just general consensus among psychiatrists that you start with this.
And it's based on the psychiatrist you're talking to and what their understanding is of the condition and what they think is going to work best. And you can go from one psychiatrist to the next, and one may go, why are you on that? And well, because so-and-so gave me this huge story as to why I should be on it. Or maybe they didn't say anything at all. Maybe they were just like, I think we're going to put you on this one. It's just great. It works really good. And either way, you're the patient. You're going to take their expertise at face value because you're trusting that they're looking out for your best interests and your health. That's why you're there, and that's their job. So you're relying on that. And then the next professional you're talking to could completely contradict that story. Like, no, I don't think that's the right one for you. We should put you on this one. And this is how it works. This is how it happens. I've been there. I've seen it. I've seen it with people I've been with. I've seen it myself when I was on some things a while ago. And it's fucking insane. I mean, it's really insane the way that it works, because there's a lot of conjecture involved, and there isn't and it's true. This is not a one size fits all by any means. We're talking about mental health or any of these drugs, but the cattle calls that are med checks or going and getting meds from certain providers sometimes are really disturbing in terms of how quickly they will move you in and move you out with just a few questions, and just thinking, if you just asked a few more questions, you might get to a little deeper of an understanding of the person's condition, and you could probably make a better decision. But it's get them in, get them out, get them prescribed, and get that money from the insurance company, from so many of these providers. I'm not saying that's what they were doing at this office, but I'm saying that is how the system works. And this is unfortunately not super abnormal for the way this system works. And that's a reality that I don't think the country wants to hear either.
And I can see telehealth working more effectively if you're dealing with like a sore throat, a headache, an upset stomach or something. But when you're dealing with psychiatry, that's a problem because Reddington highlighted this. He highlighted the behaviors that she most likely could have missed as a psychiatrist, only doing telehealth with someone in psychosis or at least dealing with postpartum depression. He said, well, if you're just seeing her from the waist up, did you know what hurt she was doing with her hands? Could you note any stress indicators? Could you know any pacifying behaviors that she was exhibiting, even as you're asking her questions? Could you take in all that data as you're making your assessment? No, you can't.
No.
And to be prescribing the level of medication she was, again, as she's feeling out, again, she was following, I believe she's following a protocol, because that's what doctors do. You're following an algorithm for diagnoses, and when you're not cross-referencing, because you're dealing with a lot of pharmaceuticals that are coming in and out of the system, and I think they, you know, to Lindsay's benefit, into her detriment at the same time, because someone highlighted while she was a nurse. And absolutely, I think part of what she was doing very well, I think, was her level of transparency and lack of shame of sharing with people was huge, because she knew in order to get treated, she needed to be transparent because she's a nurse. She understands that in order for accurate assessment, she needs that. So she was being completely transparent. And so I think people took for granted that, because if you didn't say she's in psychosis, and you, because her psychiatrist did not believe she's in psychosis, then you're going to believe all the words she's saying.
But, and surprise, no one ever says they're in psychosis.
Right.
It's like, hey, by the way, I'm in active psychosis right now. Hey, what do you think I should tell? That's not
and
how
she even said that. There, she gave the outward signs that is that can be presented if someone's in psychosis. And Lindsay wasn't having any of those signs. But then she also talked about the internal things that are going on inside the brain that would indicate psychosis. And the only way for a psychiatrist to know those is if the patient shares those things or is aware of those things going on. And I think only someone with much more experience to look at wobbles from what they'd expect from someone healthy or just going through a more 1 in 10 probability of a just postpartum depression, because she was prescribing for depression, even though the prescription the depression subscription was going to exasperate, even set on the side effects, so going to exasperate her insomnia, which is also a fuel of kerosene on the fire of the psychosis. I mean, it's just one big mess.
Which a lot of times people in these states, one of their, I can't speak for Lindsay Clancy, I've seen it, but one of the biggest fears I know with this, when you're in these sort of states, is sleep, because these medications do not help you with that. And fear of not getting enough sleep. I mean, just take all the shit out of it. Take all the postpartum, everything out of it. If you're not getting enough sleep and you're a healthy person, you're not going to be operating on all cylinders. So you already know you're not operating on all cylinders. You already have anxiety. You already got this shit going on. And all these medications are messing with you on top of your own body doing the hormones. And you're fearing that you're not getting enough sleep because your body's already not working right. And these medications mess with that as well. Add that shit show on top of everything. It's a hellish place to live for a lot of these women. And a lot of people have no clue just how horrific life is when they're in these sort of states, and how hopeless and damn near impossible it feels like to get out of, and how frustrating it must be when provider after provider is not giving you the adequate attention you need to get to a solution for where you're at. And sometimes it does take time, but it's not like Lindsay didn't give it a chance by any means.
And one more thing on the sleep deprivation thing. Sorry, Tony. This one, actually, I do have firsthand experience with. So we talked about the things you can have an auditory hallucination from psychosis, from the experience of someone just going through withdrawals, right? Well, when I was going through the Marine Corps, I was going through training at Quantico. And one of the things they do during officer training at the basic school in Quantico is they expose you to sleep deprivation during what we had when I went through called the 9-day war. And this sleep deprivation, I think I was awake nonstop for either 36 or 50 hours. See, I don't even remember accurately, because what happens, they want you to experience what your brain will do under sleep deprivation. And I can tell you what, when I hit, I think, the 50-hour point where it's at nighttime and we're in what's called a blocking position. We actually had our foxholes, and it was February here in Quantico, just north of me in Virginia, mm-hmm. where I live. I was cold as hell, and I'm sitting next to someone next to me. We're all been awake the same amount of time, and I shit you not. He looks at me and goes, did you see that? And I go, yeah, I did. We started seeing things in the woods. We started hearing things that weren't there. We saw people, images, and noises in the woods in front of us. And it was all sleep deprived and induced. Yeah. It had nothing to do with anything else. It was the massive sleep. So again, we were talking about someone who actually, and I believe it'll come out, because I think I've read this somewhere. Again, my conjecture from what I believe, yeah, I read, she actually has a genetic, because psychoses can be inherited, it can be genetic. And I think there is a history of that genetic in her family, potentially. Again, I know it'll come out in the trial if it is. But regardless, she has a psychosis. And then all these things, both the medications as well as sleep deprivation, all these things are more and more kerosene on the fire. Going to your original thing you said earlier, Tony, was that I think the probability of this happening or her being a psychosis was most likely inevitable. And yeah, all the mismanagement medication exasperated to this deadly conclusion that happened.
We're going to talk more about the difference between being psychotic and psychosis on, right, Wednesday with Siobhan.
Thank goodness.
And we're going to go deeper into this conversation on the mental health side. So I want you to join us Wednesday, 11 Central, here for that live. And if you want, you can certainly catch it on the repeat. But we're going to dive into that much deeper. There's just so much to this case. And it really requires understanding. This is not one to be flippant about, because it is very important to understand if we're ever going to do better at this. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.